morning, this is Hugh LaFollette, your host Friday's News News. On a program this week, I'm talking with Joseph Cerencione, director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, and our topic will be non-proliferation. Joseph, glad to have you on the show.
Pleasure to be here, Hugh.
I think it'd be helpful if you'd begin by specifying a little bit about exactly what your project does and maybe a little bit about the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace.
Sure. The Carnegie Endowment is a think tank, a research institute, one of the oldest in Washington, D.C., established in 1910 by Andrew Carnegie. We specialize in issues of globalization, tracking the spread of technologies, politics, interrelationship of economics around the world. And my job here is to direct the project on non-proliferation. We track the spread or efforts to constrain the spread of weapons of mass destruction, that is, nuclear, biological, or chemical weapons, and their delivery systems, such as long-range missiles. We basically track who's got what and where. We do this in a variety of means. We have a publication called Tracking Nuclear Proliferation, last published in 1998. We're about to update it with a new version coming out next year. We have a very extensive website where we give people the latest stories on proliferation, analysis of what's going on, and in-depth information on the nuclear and missile arsenals of the various countries. And during the current crisis, we're also tracking global press clips, what the world thinks about what's going on, try to get some voices from outside the United States so people can better appreciate the impact of U.S. Policies. Our website is www.ceip.org/NPP for Non-Proliferation Project.
Okay. Well, actually, I was going to ask you about that address because I assume some listeners might well want to check it up.
Well, we're very proud of our website. We think it's the best in the business, and almost everything we publish is up there. You can download it for free, no shipping and handling.
What I'd like to do, is begin by talking about the issue of nuclear non-proliferation, since that has certainly been a primary concern over the last 30 years. And then we'll begin to talk about chemical and biological, which is certainly a very heightened concern today.
Sure.
So could you tell us a little bit about the history of the efforts to control nuclear, the presence of nuclear bombs, nuclear weapons, and their delivery systems?
Well, efforts to stop the spread of atomic bombs began almost immediately after Hiroshima, when the United States dropped bombs on Hiroshima and Nagasaki in 1945. Almost immediately, the U.S. and other countries came together to try and stop the spread or use of these weapons. The U.S., for example, in 1946, had presented a plan to the new United Nations to basically agree to give the United Nations possession of the few nuclear weapons that U.S. then had, in exchange for agreements that no other nation would pursue this technology and that all stockpiles of uranium and plutonium would be controlled only by the United Nations. It was a very elaborate plan headed by a guy named Bernard Baruch. It quickly ran into Cold War tensions as the rivalry with the Soviet Union heated up, and it foundered. Nothing ever came of it. But repeatedly, people return to this subject as the nuclear arsenals of first the United States grew, then the Soviet Union detonated an atomic device in 1949. We were no longer alone. And they were joined fairly quickly by Great Britain, with the United States assistance detonated nuclear weapons. And then by 1964, China and France had joined the nuclear club. So you had five nuclear nations, the same five open nuclear nations that remain today: United States, Soviet Union, Great Britain, France, and China. During that period, there were repeated efforts to try and slow this arms race, try to contain it. At the beginning of the 1960s, President Kennedy feared that by the end of the 1960s, there could be 15, 20, or 25 nations with nuclear weapons unless we did something. This, he said, would make for a more unstable world, a more dangerous world, and would make it almost certain that someone somewhere would use a nuclear weapon. We have to end this arms race, he said, before it ends us. fortunately, the United States did do something, and by 1968, we had negotiated the Treaty on Nuclear Nonproliferation, which was an agreement from most of the countries in the world. 100 countries signed up to it immediately, that no other country would acquire nuclear weapons in exchange for the United States and the other nuclear powers agreeing to work towards reduction of their nuclear arsenals and eventual nuclear disarmament. Over the years, this treaty and other treaties that grew up around it worked very well. We formed an interlocking network of treaties and agreements that has effectively prevented and reduced the nuclear danger and chemical and biological dangers. In the 1950s and 1960s, both the United States and the Soviet Union had very large, ready-to-use stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons. President Nixon ended the biological weapons program in the United States and led negotiations for what they call a biological weapons convention that banned biological weapons anywhere in the world. That was signed in the 1970s and is now in effect. President Bush, first President Bush, led the effort to negotiate a chemical weapons convention that did the same for chemical weapons. That treaty is also now into effect. So you have these three core treaties, the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, the Biological Weapons Convention, and now the Chemical Weapons Convention, that constrain and reduce the threat from these kinds of systems. They've been highly successful. Since the Nonproliferation Treaty was negotiated, only three other nations have developed nuclear weapons, more than we'd like, but not the 15 or 20 that President Kennedy feared. Those three other countries are India and Pakistan, who detonated nuclear devices in 1998, and Israel, which is an undeclared nuclear state, and neither denies nor acknowledges possession of what most scholars believe is about 60 to 100 nuclear weapons that Israel possesses. Outside of that, no other country has nuclear weapons, although there are several that we're worried about, and those include Iran, Iraq, and North Korea. So that's the short history of the proliferation of nuclear weapons and biological and chemical and efforts to control them. It's a serious problem, but thanks to this kind of diplomacy and these treaties, not as bad as we were afraid it could get in the 1960s.
All right, well, let's go back. I mean, you said that at the time when John Kennedy became very concerned about it, five countries had these abilities. And he was concerned that it could be reached 25 by the end of the century. What specifically, I mean, was the worry then? I mean, why is it worse to have 25 rather than 5?
Sure. Well, what he was worried about then, and people sometimes forget this, with all our concentration on so-called rogue states like Iran and Iraq, what he was worried about was that the industrial countries would acquire nuclear weapons. After all, the United States had them in the beginning of the 1960s. The Soviet Union had them. France had just acquired them, and Great Britain. Well, why didn't other countries need them? Sweden, for example, had an active nuclear weapons program. Australia, Germany was interested. Italy had a program. Countries we don't really think about these days. And the fear was that if Japan and Germany and other major industrial countries got them, then every local conflict would become a potential nuclear conflict. That if many countries, large and small, had nuclear weapons, that the United States would get, and other countries would be drawn into local conflicts, and struggles that would be otherwise be local in nature would become global. And this would make for not just a more unstable world, but a real and present danger to U.S. national security. And of course, you know, the more nuclear weapons you have, the greater the chance is that people would actually use them and might use them against the United States. It's sort of an obvious but not often articulated fear. Fortunately, with the use of both the treaty mechanism and the NATO alliance, where the U.S. promised to come to the aid of any country that was attacked by nuclear weapons, they were able to douse the interest in both among U.S. allies and among other countries to acquire those nuclear weapons. And we've kept it to a relatively small number of countries, although the arsenals are quite large.
All right. The one thing I think that's not actually specifically part but it certainly is deeply related to it, is that part of the strategy, of the nuclear strategy of those years, was a strategy called MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction. Could you briefly explain what that theory was and why it was thought to dictate that we sign, in addition to our other treaties, that we sign anti-ballistic missile treaties?
Yeah, well, MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, isn't really a policy or even a theory as much as it is a condition of the nuclear age. As long as countries have large numbers of nuclear weapons, they will have the ability to wreak destruction on other countries. And in the case of the United States and the Soviet Union, their arsenals were so large that it was clear that if one side attacked the other with nuclear weapons, the other would have enough nuclear weapons left to retaliate with such overwhelming force that they would assure the destruction of the attacking country. So it was mutual assured destruction. The first use of nuclear weapons would result in an assured counter response, and that would result in the mutual destruction of both countries. Neither side wanted mutual assured destruction. Each side wanted to have assured destruction of the other, but the condition of the nuclear age is when you get weapons this powerful, remember, one bomb can destroy a city, a large city, that's the situation you find yourself in. And as long as there are large arsenals, mutual assured destruction will remain a part of our existence, of the conditions of the existence on this planet. The only way to avoid mutual assured destruction, it's not a policy shift, it has to be an actual arsenal shift, reducing down to very small or no numbers of nuclear weapons.
In your recounting of the history, I mean, one of the things that was really very interesting, I suspect to many of the listeners, is that many of the, with the exception of John Kennedy, whom you mentioned, the principal leaders in some ways in trying to bring about these treaties, in negotiating them, in signing them, and bringing them to effect, had been Republicans.
Oh, in many ways, the existing non-proliferation regime has been a Republican-built regime. Most of the treaties and agreements have been negotiated by Republican presidents, although supported by largely Democratic Congresses. Ronald Reagan, for example, led the way with the major nuclear arms reduction treaties, the START treaties, that for the first time actually cut the nuclear arsenals of the two powers, not just limited them. He also negotiated the Intermediate Nuclear Force Agreement, whereby the United States and the Soviet Union destroyed all their medium-range missiles, anything above 500 kilometers in range, all the way up to, but not including, the long-range intercontinental missiles, were destroyed, removed from the Russian and Soviet arsenal. There's still, it's an unprecedented agreement. Each side destroyed almost 2,000 weapons. This was a Republican arms control. Although people sometimes think of President Reagan for his promotion of the Star Wars program and his initial boost in the military budget, he was one of the greatest arms controllers of all times, and President Bush followed up with the START II agreement that further reduced nuclear arsenals, the Chemical Weapons Convention, and in 1991, unilateral measures to pull back and destroy tactical nuclear weapons. President Bush took all tactical weapons away from the Army. There were no longer nuclear artillery shells, for example, and from the surface Navy. No longer we have nuclear depth charges or nuclear rockets fired from surface ships. These were really remarkable achievements. So the reductions in nuclear weapons, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, although inspired by Kennedy, negotiated by Johnson, was actually signed by Richard Nixon. The Biological Weapons Convention, the Chemical Weapons Convention, the ABM Treaty itself, limiting missile defenses, also signed by Richard Nixon. Most of these treaties and agreements done by Republican presidents. It turns out that Republicans have both a greater trust among the American people to do these kinds of agreements and greater political freedom. They're not worried about being attacked by the right because the right is already part of their party. The right has nowhere to go. And when a Ronald Reagan says this treaty is good for America, it turns out he has overwhelming support for that kind of statement and that kind of treaty.
Okay, I want to expand on a number of these themes in the second half of the show. This is Ideas and Issues. My guest today is Joseph Cerincione, director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Let me go back. You began just recently, before the break, talking about all the ways in which we had dismantled missiles. It seems to me that that would be the superpowers into the deal. I mean, as you described the initial treaty to which so many nations signed on, part of the treaty was that they would not develop new weapons if the superpowers would make efforts to cut back on their number of weapons. And that in essence, Reagan, Bush, and so on, Bush Sr., kept their end of the bargain, at least in part, by cutting back on the number of weapons. Is that correct, and would that be one of the things that would make some of the other countries less likely to try to develop weapons on their own?
Well, this has been one of the great tensions and frustrations in this effort. Remember, the Non-Proliferation Treaty was signed in 1968, came into force in 1970. Now, every country in the world except four are members of this treaty. This is one of the most universal treaties in existence. The four are Cuba, which stays out for ideological reasons, India, Pakistan, and Israel. Every other country is a member. The non-nuclear weapon states have been constantly frustrated by the slow pace of nuclear reductions from the other side, and frustrated that other countries, for example, India and Pakistan, continue to acquire nuclear weapons. What's going on, they say? We've kept our side of the bargain. We, Germany, Japan, Sweden, Iran, for that matter, have not acquired nuclear weapons. And yet the arsenals are not coming down as quickly as we thought they would be. They are coming down. There are dramatic reductions. In a few years, the United States and Russia will have reduced some 80% from their Cold War peaks. However, they still have very large arsenals. The United States today has some 10,000 nuclear weapons. Russia has approximately 20,000 nuclear weapons of all kinds, strategic, long-range, short-range, suitcase nukes, all kinds of nuclear weapons. If a country has 10,000 nuclear weapons, how can you tell another country that it shouldn't have one? How can you tell North Korea that it has no right to acquire two or three nuclear weapons? North Korea is a part of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. Some suspected of cheating on that agreement, but so far as we know, they have kept their word. Part of the deal was for these countries to continually take steps to prove that they were eventually working towards disarmament. So the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was negotiated in 1996, where all the countries agreed not to stop testing nuclear weapons. No longer would a country test a nuclear weapon. And in fact, there hasn't been a test anywhere since 1996. But President Bush has decided he doesn't like that treaty. The Republican Senate rejected that treaty, and that has been a major setback for efforts to constrain nuclear weapons, and has caused doubts among the non-nuclear weapon states about how serious the United States and the other powers are about keeping their end of the bargain. This is a constant tension, a constant struggle. It goes back and forth. Right now, I would say, the chances of somebody breaking out of the treaty are actually higher than they have been in recent years.
In fact, you said that the current President Bush is not sympathetic, nor is the current Congress. What's led to the change? Historically, the Republicans have been the prime movers in favor of these sorts of treaties. Now, all of a sudden, they seem to be opposed to them. Do you have any explanation of what's happened?
Well, it does run hot and cold. In a nutshell, what's happened is that the Republican Party has become much more conservative in recent years than it ever has been, primarily with the Republican leadership in the Senate taking a very hard right turn around 1994 when Newt Gingrich led the effort to regain the House of Representatives. And we have a very ideological leadership in the party right now that rejects the whole idea of arms control treaties. It's not just this treaty is no good. That they fear that these treaties are worse than having no treaties at all because they will lull America into a false sense of security, that many of these treaties will constrain U.S. options. For example, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty prohibits us from testing new nuclear weapons. Some of these folks want to test new nuclear weapons. The ABM Treaty stops us from deploying more than a limited missile defense system. They want to have a very expansive missile defense system. And other treaties, like the Biological Weapons Convention, don't hurt us because we have no intention of deploying biological weapons, but they fear they give a cover to other countries who will sign the treaty but cheat on it. So they fear this lulls us into this false sense of security. We're better off without any of these treaties and relying just on U.S. military strength and military might. I believe that this strain has led to a whole series of decisions by the administration to reject treaty after treaty, to opt out of multilateral arrangements in favor of reliance on U.S. military force, increases in U.S. military budgets, and exploration of various new nuclear options, such as construction of new nuclear weapons and missile defenses. That we may be seeing an end to that phase. As I say, historically it runs hot and cold. We saw it in the beginning of the Reagan administration. It peaked around from 1980 to 1984. The Reagan administration took a turn and became a leader in arms control efforts. We may be seeing that kind of effort, that change here in the George Bush administration because of the crisis in Afghanistan. Suddenly we've moved from a country that has wanted little to do with multilateral arrangements to a country that's trying to construct an unprecedented global alliance. To do that, you got to have cooperation, you have to have treaties, you have to have agreements and arrangements. The administration may be forced and now may be embracing a whole new phase of its foreign policy, which I believe will include new efforts to stop the proliferation of weapons of mass destruction, and that means treaties.
In short, we've suddenly realized that we can't do it alone. We can't just rely simply upon U.S. military might, particularly in a situation like this, that we have to have the cooperation of others.
That's exactly right. There are some problems that are so difficult that no nation, no matter how powerful, can solve it by themselves.
All right. In the last, it's hard to acknowledge this, we have only a little over 5 minutes left. Let's talk about chemical and biological weapons, because that's suddenly becoming an increasing concern. It's been discussed ever since September the 11th, and it's been discussed certainly much more recently with the appearance of the case of anthrax in Florida. What's the current status of our efforts, and what are the particular problems of trying to control chemical and biological weapons of mass destruction?
Well, first of all, chemical and biological weapons are globally illegal. No country is allowed to have them. Almost every country has signed up to these two treaties prohibiting them. So any country that would have a chemical or biological weapon is required to destroy them. The U.S., for example, and Russia are in the process of destroying their vast Cold War stockpiles. And no other country is allowed to produce a chemical or biological weapon. So that's a good thing. The global norm is to prohibit and ban these weapons completely. The trouble is, of course, that some nations may be cheating on such an agreement, or that a group, not a nation, could acquire or develop biological weapons. Aum Shinrikyo, the cult terrorist group in Japan, spent years and millions trying to develop a biological weapon, actually failed. They showed how difficult it was. They did get a hold of a chemical weapon, a sarin nerve gas, that they sprayed in the Tokyo subway system, but killed dozens, sent hundreds to the hospital. But in many ways, that experience showed how difficult it is for a group to do this. These weapons are extremely difficult to manufacture and to disseminate properly. They require proper dissemination to really cause mass casualties. So that the concern about chemical and biological weapons is well-founded. It's a little overdone, though. It's a little overdone. I wouldn't be afraid of a large-scale chemical or biological weapons attack at this point. As it turns out, and as September 11th showed us, there are much easier and cheaper ways to cause mass casualties in the United States rather than using these exotic, difficult to use, and expensive form of destruction.
All right. I realize, though, there certainly is one worry that the current crisis has prompted, and that is the fact that Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons and the tenuous position that Pakistan holds with respect to Afghanistan and the Taliban. Yeah. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that in the last couple of minutes.
This is exactly the kind of danger that President Kennedy was worried about. Here you have a country, Pakistan, that has a number of nuclear weapons. We don't know how many. We estimate they have enough material to have produced approximately 40 nuclear weapons. Maybe they only have 10 or 20. We just don't know. It's undeclared. But it's an unstable country. And we have never conducted a major war like we're doing now in Afghanistan on the border of an unstable nuclear country. We're in uncharted territory here. There are three worst-case scenarios. One is that the Taliban itself or Osama bin Laden were actually to attack a Pakistan nuclear facility and gain control of nuclear weapons. I think that's unlikely. These are very highly guarded by crack troops. Two is that Pakistan itself could become unstable, could fracture as a result of military opposition to Pakistan's support for the American operation in Afghanistan. In that case, nuclear weapons could fall into the hands of mutinous military forces or find their way into Taliban or Osama bin Laden hands or Iraqi hands, for that matter. The bomb really could just leave Pakistan and travel through the region. That is a real danger. The third danger is that India might be tempted to take advantage of the situation, for example, instability in Pakistan, and try to force a settlement of the Kashmir issue, that disputed territory between India and Pakistan, by military means. If they do so, the Pakistan government may decide to use nuclear weapons to repel an Indian attack, prompting an Indian atomic nuclear attack, and you will have the world's first nuclear war occurring. In this case, in South Asia. Those are the three worst-case scenarios. Unfortunately, two of those are very real concerns. We have to be very worried about it. We would all be a lot better off if Pakistan and India didn't have nuclear weapons. We can't roll back the clock. Now we're stuck with the results of this proliferation. It could get a lot worse.
All right. In 45 minutes, is there any sort of last point you would like to make for the listeners?
About 45 minutes.
45 seconds.
A lot of points, but for 45 seconds, I would say that the dangers are real. There are very bad, worst-case scenarios out there. There are plenty of things we could do about it. This is not a hopeless situation. We can, for example, triple our efforts to lock up and secure the remaining nuclear weapons and materials in the states of the former Soviet Union. We could do dramatic reductions of the U.S. nuclear arsenal. We can take steps to secure Pakistan's forces or have contingency plans for airlifting some of those weapons out in a worst-case scenario. We can diplomatically restrain India. There are plenty of things we can do about it if our leaders have the wisdom and the will to do them.
All right. Thank you very much for appearing on the show today.
My pleasure, Hugh. Thank you for having me.
I've been speaking today with Joseph Cerencion, director of the Non-Proliferation Project at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. This is Hugh LaFollette, Friday's Issues. Good day.